hoping to prevent any further pain. The man was lying. He had a very distinct tell.
Bullshit, Harbath repeated. You weren't paid so that he could end up in a refugee camp.
I was, the man insisted, a little too quickly. The tell was the icing on the cake. Harvath stepped forward and sliced the man's finger the rest of the way off. Halim rocked in his chair, screaming. Harvath went back and leaned against the wall. Considering the horror the smuggler had visited upon his victims, Harvath didn't feel a shred of remorse. Halim was evil incarnate. He deserved much worse. When enough time had passed, Harvath once again re-engaged. For as big as he was, the man was a mess. He was shaking, his eyes were bloodshot, and perspiration and tears stained his face. He had lost a lot of his color.
This is the last time I'm going to ask this, he said. What was the VIP supposed to do when he reached Italy?
The smuggler refused to answer. Grabbing his other hand, Harvath pressed his knife down and began cutting into the same finger.
What was the VIP supposed to do when he reached Italy?
A fishing boat, Halim shouted. Off the coast of Lampedusa.
What about it?
It was supposed to pick him up and take him the rest of the way.
Whose fishing boat?
I don't know.
Harvath sliced deeper into his finger and blood began to spurt out.
The Mafia!
Halim cried.
Give me a name,
he demanded,
or this is going to get a lot more painful.
Chapter 42. Leaving the bedroom, he stopped in the kitchen for a second cup of coffee. Unplugging his satellite phone from its charger, he carried it upstairs, along with his coffee, out onto the balcony. It was at least 15 degrees cooler at the coast than it had been inland. As he fired up the phone and waited for it to acquire a signal, he took a deep breath of the ocean air. It smelled and sounded exactly the same as it had yesterday. Despite everything that had happened, at least that hadn't changed. There might have been a lesson in there somewhere for him, but at this moment, he didn't have the mental bandwidth to grapple with it. When the signal icon appeared on his phone, he relayed everything the smuggler had told him to Deborah Lovett, his CIA contact at the embassy in Rome. She told him she'd get back to him as soon as she had something. After that, all he could do was wait. He needed sleep, but with two cups of coffee in his system and so many things weighing on his mind, he was too wired. That wasn't like him. Normally, he could calm his thoughts enough to slip into an almost meditative state that allowed him to replenish his strength. Today, though, had been anything but normal. He was still keyed up, expecting a fight. Until the boats arrived, he wouldn't be able to relax, not even for a moment. He felt fully responsible for his team, including their injuries. But considering everything that had happened, it could have been much worse. The bullet that hit Haney could have severed an artery or shattered his leg. It hadn't. And while Gage would have his left arm in a sling for a while, his wound could have been a lot worse, too. All things considered, they'd been pretty fortunate to all be getting out of this alive. It was a testament to both their courage and their skill. Sometimes, shit just happened. Unable to unwind, he put his mind toward what to do with the smuggler and the satellite phone salesman. Neither had any further intelligence value. He thought about killing them. Halim certainly deserved it, and in his mind, Harvath could make the argument that the phone salesman deserved it too. He certainly wasn't going to cut them loose. Listening to the sound of the ocean on the beach below, he let the pieces tumble in his mind. As he did, an idea began to form. After making sure it was fully baked, he transmitted it back to Langley. It was common knowledge that the locals, as well as the fledgling Libyan government, didn't like the human traffickers. Plenty of their boats had sunk only a few miles out to sea. When that happened, bodies washed up on Libya's beaches. Harvath decided the best thing he could do was to leave their two captives right where they were, tied up in the safe house. Once he and the team were safely away, the Libyan government could be tipped off. They could then perp-walk the smuggler and his accomplice on TV. Rounding up one of the most feared smugglers in the country would make them look strong and competent. Freeing all the refugees locked up at his compound would further burnish their image as just and compassionate. And if they were smart, they'd vilify and undermine the power of the Libya Liberation Front by tying them to the monstrous smuggler. By claiming that it was government forces that had clashed with the militia overnight and this morning while attempting to capture Halim, they'd look strong and brave. It was a win-win-win that gave the new government everything tied up with a ribbon. McGee liked the plan, too, and felt a high degree of confidence that the Libyan government would go for it. He also shared with Harvath that identifying the stolen Glocks from Camp 27 had turned out to be a big help in speeding up the earlier drone handoff. This made the Defense Department, which was eager to settle that score, move faster. Also, once the Tunisians were informed of the evidence connecting the Libya Liberation Front and Ansar al-Sharia, they gladly took themselves out of the loop and allowed the attack to happen. They were two small hash marks on a much larger balance sheet, but had just one of them been removed, there was no telling how things might have turned out. When darkness fell and the high-speed assault craft with their knife-like hulls arrived off the coast, six SEAL team members slipped over the sides and swam to shore. Harvath was on the beach, waiting for them when they arrived, and led them up to the safe house. There, the SEALs passed out waterproof dry bags for everyone to load up their gear, including the surveillance equipment Morrison had stripped from the van. The SEALs then did a quick assessment and made plans for getting everyone out. Harvath had his own ideas, but he kept them to himself. This was what these men were paid to do. If they wanted his opinion, they'd ask for it. The biggest challenge was moving Haney, but the SEAL team had come prepared. HSACs, as long as they weren't getting pounded by waves in a surf zone, could come in very close to shore. The CIA couldn't have known when they chose the safe house, but the location had been perfect. Using an inflatable stretcher that looked like some kind of tactical pool toy, they were able to carry Haney out of the house and down to the beach. Once everyone was assembled, they called in the boats. Harvath and Stalin stayed behind with two of the SEALs to cover the rest of the team as they waded out chest-high in the water and climbed onto the boats. When they were aboard, Harvath and Stalin followed. The two SEALs on the beach came next. The newcomers were issued Mustang inflatable flotation devices and headsets, which were quickly put on and plugged in. Blankets were offered, but none of Harvath's steely-eyed killers would be caught dead wrapped in a blanket. They had come into Libya like warriors, and that was exactly how they were going to leave. With all present and accounted for, the boat crews pointed their HSACs toward open water and slammed the throttles forward. Chapter 43. Paris. It was after 9 p.m. when the chemist, accompanied by two other young men, also in prayer caps, exited the mosque in Aubervilliers. Puffing on a Gauloise, Tursunov watched from across the street. The two young men were the same he had seen Eunice with that morning. Now, instead of saying goodbye and heading home, Eunice was walking off with them in another direction. There were only two reasons Tursunov could think of for why the authorities would be following a young, unemployed Muslim chemist. One reason was terrorism. The other reason was drugs. It wasn't until he saw the second cop following Eunice that morning that the scales tipped for him. With his longer hair and goatee, that officer had drug detail written all over him. Drugs and terrorism often went hand in hand. The Taliban made the bulk of their income from opium, and the cell that carried out the Madrid train bombing had financed its attack by selling drugs. If Eunice and his colleagues were involved with drugs, it was no wonder that the French authorities had taken an interest in them. The surveillance team appeared about a block from the mosque. They were different players than Tursunov had spotted that morning. Over the next 6 blocks, there were at least 3 different police officers who rotated in and out behind the young men as they walked. Tursunov also spotted a small Renault hatchback that had looped around the block twice, ignoring 2 perfectly good parking spots. After another block, he could see where they were headed. Eunice and his colleagues entered a crowded cafe and disappeared inside. None of the surveillance team followed. The Renault hatchback double-parked several doors down. The first man from the rotation, who was now wearing a jacket and a ball cap, walked into a pharmacy and browsed near the window where he could watch the street. Tursunov decided to make his move. Stepping into the cafe, he noticed that it was filled completely with men. There wasn't a single woman to be seen. It was loud and smelled like urinal disinfectant. Soccer games were on all of the TVs. Many men were playing cards. Others were smoking shisha pipes. Approaching the comptoir, he ordered a Coke. The North African behind the bar looked at him long and hard. It was obvious his customer wasn't from the neighborhood. He seemed to be deciding whether to serve him or throw him out. Removing a large roll of cash from his pocket, Tursunov peeled off a 10, set it on the counter, and then turned his back on the barman to study the room. Off in a corner, Eunice and his buddies had joined a group of other young North African men. Tursunov doubted any of them had just come from the mosque. They sported gold jewelry and expensive basketball shoes. They were street thugs, probably gang members. It would not have surprised him if they had violent criminal histories. He watched as the man who appeared to be the leader nodded at one of his lieutenants. The lieutenant withdrew 3 envelopes from inside his waistband and handed 1 each to Eunice and his 2 friends. As he did, Tursunov thought he could see a pistol. Neither Eunice nor his colleagues opened the envelopes to see what was inside. As quickly as they appeared, they disappeared into the young men's pockets. Tursunov was all but certain at this point that his hypothesis regarding Eunice was correct. All he needed was a confession. So when the lieutenant stood up to go use the men's room, he decided to extract one. Taking another sip of his Coke, he glanced at the barman, who was at the other end of the comptoir. His attention was on a newly arrived group of customers. Back at Eunice's table, the young men were engrossed in a serious discussion. None of them were even keeping an eye on the front, much less the traffic headed to and from the restroom. Setting his Coke down on the bar, Tursunov collected his change and walked back to the men's room, eyeballing the location of the rear exit as he did. As he opened the door, he saw 1 man at the sink washing his hands and heard another man standing at one of the urinals. The man finishing up at the lone sink looked at him in the mirror. The Tajik raised his hands like a surgeon and nodded at the water, indicating he needed to use the sink next. Turning off the water, the man grabbed several paper towels from the dispenser and dried his hands as he exited. Tursunov turned the water back on to mask the sound of his movements. Slipping across the dingy tiles, he quietly locked the door. Then, like a ghost, he materialized behind the lieutenant at the urinal. The street thug was 3 inches taller, 50 pounds heavier, and a good 30 years younger than the Tajik. But if life had taught him anything, it was that there was no substitute for experience and treachery. It had also taught him that a man was never so vulnerable as when he had his dick out. Taking full advantage of the element of surprise, he drove the lieutenant's head right into the wall above the urinal. Simultaneously, he pulled the man's pistol, a 9mm Pamas G1, from his waistband and drove the barrel into the base of his skull. When the man tried to fight back, Tursunov slammed his boot into the back of the man's right knee, causing him to fall face first into the urinal. Grabbing a fistful of the man's hair, he forced him to remain there.
"What were the envelopes for?" he demanded. "Go fuck yourself," the man replied defiantly in French.
Tursunov knew some French, but not enough to carry out an interrogation.
"English,"
he demanded, as he moved the pistol to the man's temple, cocked the hammer, and released the safety.
"What were the envelopes for?" "Money,"
the man relented.
"Money." "Money for what?"
When the man didn't answer, The Tajik jerked his head back and then slammed his face into the porcelain urinal, breaking three of his teeth.
Money for what?
He repeated.
Putain!
The lieutenant cursed as blood gushed from his mouth. Fuck. Turzanov jerked his head back again, and the man yelled,
Drugs! It was for drugs!
Just as he had thought.
What kind? Crystal!
They sold you methamphetamine?
No,
said the lieutenant.
Partnership. They cook, we sell.
Who is we?
Mon bond.
English,
the Tajik growled, whacking the man's forehead on the urinal.
Fils de pute,
he replied. Son of a bitch.
My crew sells it. My gang.
Turzanov's mind was already turning three steps ahead. Every gang had to deal with turf wars and competition.
What gang is your enemy? Which one is trying to take your business?
Les Jebets,
the man sputtered.
The ghetto boys from Saint-Denis.
That was all Turzanov needed to hear. This time, when he slammed the lieutenant's head into the porcelain, he did it hard enough to knock him out. Letting go of his hair, he pulled a knife and slit the man's throat. Then, holding the lieutenant's index finger and using his blood as ink, he wrote the letters GB on the wall. After washing his hands, he unlocked the bathroom door and left the cafe by the rear exit. He had just taken the first step in helping his chemist disappear. Chapter 44. Malta. The trip took over 4 hours. They stopped once to refuel. Bladders full of diesel with special beacons attached had been airdropped over the water. When they got within range of Malta, Harvath made a call. By the time they reached the drop point, several vehicles were already waiting for them. It was on a secluded stretch of coastline, which was good for a covert insertion, but the rocks made it difficult to get in as close as they would have liked. Instead of wading into shore, they had to swim. The warm waters around Malta were a particular favorite of great white sharks, which flocked there to give birth. Harvath tried not to think about it, as he helped swim Gage's stretcher into shore behind Haney's. Neither man was up to the task of swimming, and the last thing they needed was the scent of blood in the water. Standing in the surf, ready to help bring the stretchers in, was a team of men. Harvath knew one of the faces well. Dr. Vela was a slim man in his 50s. He was of average height with dark hair and glasses. He looked like someone better suited to picking stocks than running a highly fortified, top-secret interrogation and detention center, a half-hour outside of the capital of Valletta. Nicknamed the Solarium, because much of it existed below ground, it was one of the most efficient black sites on the planet. Harvath had rendered more than a few high-value targets to Vela for interrogation. As Haney's floating stretcher neared shore, the doctor gave orders in Maltese, and his men took over. Wading into the waves, they lifted it, carried it to the beach, and up to a waiting black Suburban, in which all of the seats had been folded down. By the time they returned for Gage, he had already hopped off his stretcher and was wading in. He didn't need or want any further help. With their cargo safely delivered, the SEALs returned to their boats and headed off to rendezvous with a ship from the 6th Fleet. Harvath stepped out of the water and shook Vela's hand.
You look terrible, the doctor said.
It's been a long couple of days.
So I've heard, he replied, gesturing toward the vehicles. I have two medical teams standing by. The sooner we get back, the sooner I can have your men looked at.
Harvath thanked him, and once all his guys and their dry bags were loaded, climbed into the lead Suburban with Vela. Vela had outfitted all of the vehicles with power bars and bottles of water. Harvath helped himself.
There's hot food waiting at the farm, Vela offered.
The Solarium was built beneath a rustic farmhouse. When he took breaks from observing interrogations, Harvath liked to sit outside with a drink. Often Vela would join him, and the two would discuss all sorts of topics. Sometimes Harvath would just sit alone and enjoy the sights and sounds of rural Malta. It was one of the most peaceful and picturesque places he had ever been. Tonight, though, all he wanted was a hot shower, a bed, and silence. He'd even be willing to take one of the isolation cells if it meant a solid 8 to 10 hours of uninterrupted sleep. Leaning back against the seat, he wanted to close his eyes, but he willed himself to stay awake. Not until the solarium. Then they'd be safe, and he could let his guard down. He looked out the window and thought he recognized where they were.
"This looks familiar."
Vela smiled.
"You have a good memory. The last time you were here, we ate at a restaurant off this road. Very few people ever come back here. That's why I like it."
Harvath nodded. He didn't feel much like making conversation. He had been sent halfway around the world to piece together the itinerary of a dead ISIS chemist. Two of his team members had now been shot, and all he had to show for it was a single name, allegedly tied to the Sicilian mafia. Vela could tell Harvath was wiped out. He left him alone, and they made the rest of the drive in silence. Arriving at the farm, Haney and Gage were offloaded first and taken to the infirmary. Because interrogations at the solarium could be so intense, each prisoner was given a workup beforehand to try to identify any pre-existing medical conditions. There were also the occasional subjects who succumbed to strokes or heart attacks during the process. When that happened, Vela's team couldn't simply summon the local ambulance service. They had to take care of things on their own. Therefore, they had a fully equipped medical suite, as well as a team of highly paid medical personnel who quietly worked at the facility on a rotating basis. There wasn't much, short of highly specialized or highly technical surgeries, that they couldn't handle. The remaining team members were given room assignments and told to help themselves to dinner in the kitchen. Harvath stumbled back there, poured himself a large mug of coffee, and walked to his room. He wanted to grab a quick shower, change his clothes, and then check on Haney and Gage. As tired as he was, he couldn't turn in until he knew they were both okay. Dropping his clothes in a pile in the corner of the bathroom, he turned the water on and waited for it to get hot. As he did, he looked in the mirror. His body was covered with bruises. Diving out of a Land Cruiser and getting knocked to the ground by RPG explosions had a way of taking their toll. When the water was good and hot, he grabbed his coffee and stepped into the shower, afraid he'd fall asleep without it. He let the water pound against him, and for the first time in a long while, closed his eyes. Taking a sip of coffee, he tried, just for a moment, to push everything out of his mind. He wanted to not think of anything, to not be responsible for anything or anyone, for just 10 seconds. And for once, he got exactly what he wished for. Chapter 45. Harvath stood under the water for a good 10 minutes, drinking his coffee and not thinking about anything. When his mug was empty, he set it down, picked up a bar of soap, and scrubbed his entire body. Then, after rinsing off, he shampooed his hair. Throwing the temperature control all the way to cold, he forced himself to stand beneath the icy needles of water for a full 20 seconds. It was like dropping 2 shots of espresso into his coffee. Wide awake, he stepped out of the shower and retrieved a courtesy kit from the medicine cabinet. Inside, he found a comb, a razor, shaving cream, a toothbrush, and toothpaste. After he was done in the bathroom, he pulled a set of clothes from his bag and got dressed. Grabbing a bottle of water from the mini-fridge as he exited the room, he swallowed a couple of Motrin and headed down the hall toward the stairs that led to the infirmary. The house always smelled like maple syrup to him, which seemed strange, as it was on a farm in the middle of Malta. No doubt it had something to do with Vela wanting to create a certain atmosphere outside the solarium. The doctor held PhDs in both psychiatry and neurochemistry and was obsessed with smell, particularly its ability to open up pathways into the brain. In fact, Harvath had once watched him interrogate someone using liquid fear. It was a synthetic pheromone he had created that triggered the flight portion of the famous fight-or-flight response. It was amazing to behold. Upon arrival, everyone had been issued a key card. Harvath held his up to the reader that controlled the stairwell door. When it clicked, the door opened with a hiss, and he headed down to the solarium. The moment the door closed behind him, the maple syrup smell was gone. It was replaced by something colder, more institutional. The black site smelled like what it was, a prison. As he passed the cell doors, they were all open. The solarium was only a temporary detention facility. Anyone requiring a long-term hold was transferred elsewhere. Everything was painted gray, the walls, the floors, even the ceilings. The only exceptions were the stainless steel sink and toilet units in the cells themselves, and the bright white of the infirmary. Walking into the outer office area, Harvath saw Vella in front of a large computer screen, chatting with one of the doctors. The three men shook hands, and Harvath asked,
"How long do they each have?"
The doctor grinned.
"Considering their luck, they'll both probably live to be 100. "The rest of the guys will be sorry to hear that," Harvath replied. "Haney has a pretty wife."
Still smiling, the doctor shook his head and pointed at the computer screen. There were two digital X-rays up.
The wounds on both men were through and through, no bone fractures, and based on the rest of the tests, no vascular injury. We've got them on oral hydration and have started antibiotics and pain meds.
"How soon can they move?"
"I'd let them sleep tonight, but there's no reason they can't be on a plane tomorrow."
"Back CONUS?"
he asked, using the military acronym for Continental United States. The doc shook his head.
U.S. Naval Hospital Sigonella is the closest American facility able to give them a full workup. If they're on agency contracts, that's where they'll go. If they're at capacity, they'll turf them to Ramstein Air Base. Either way, they have to be cleared on this side of the pond before they fly home.
"Understood,"
said Harvath. "Have they been told the news yet?" "I was just about to go in."
Grabbing a folder from a stack sitting on the desk, Harvath replied,
"Don't worry. I'll take care of it."
He walked down the hallway and entered the 4-bed infirmary. Haney and Gage had been set up in beds right next to each other. "They sent Harvath," said the burly Green Beret as he walked in. "The news must be terrible." Haney chuckled. "Yeah, the human bullet magnet. That's close enough, Harvath. Neither of us wants to get shot again." He was glad to see them in good spirits. Getting shot wasn't fun. He took the ribbing in stride. Opening the folder, he said,
"I've got good news, and I've got bad news."
Both men looked at him, not sure if he was serious or if he was kidding around. Haney spoke up first. "What's the bad news?"
"You're going to lose the leg. The good news," he said with a smile, turning to Gage, "is that you'll just have to use your other arm to shave your back."
"Fuck you," they both said, laughing.
"In all seriousness," he continued, "the agency is going to want to get you checked out at a base hospital in Europe before you fly back. Sigonella is the closest, so that's probably where we're headed tomorrow."
"What about you?" Haney asked. "Any update from Rome?"
"Not yet. We'll probably hear something in the morning. In the meantime, get some sleep."
Walking back upstairs to the kitchen, Harvath decided to get some real food in his stomach. Vella had done a good job of anticipating what his American guests might like. There was a large vat of Texas chili on the stove, cornbread still warm in the oven, and cold bottles of Belgian beer in the fridge. Harvath fixed himself a meal, grabbed a beer, and headed out to the patio. The rest of the team had already eaten and gone to bed. It was a warm, quiet night. Flickering lights spilled from old lanterns placed around the patio. As he sat down, he realized he'd forgotten a bottle opener. Too tired to go back and get one, he made sure nobody was watching, and then used the edge of the table to pop the cap off. Leaning back, he took a long pull and closed his eyes. Every muscle in his body was sore. A cold beer was exactly what he needed. If he never saw Libya or another shitty third world country like it ever again, it would be too soon. He knew it was the fatigue talking. Taking another sip, he opened his eyes and leaned forward. He didn't want to fall asleep outside. Though Vella had done a good job with the food, Harvath was too wiped out to finish. Carrying everything back inside to the kitchen, he then headed down the hall to his room. When he got there, he drew the blackout curtains, kicked off his boots, and turned his phone all the way off, something he rarely ever did. If a life-or-death situation arose, he didn't want to get that call. Not tonight. Someone else would have to handle it. All he wanted to do now was sleep. Falling on the bed, he closed his eyes, and within seconds, was completely out. Chapter 46. Wednesday. When Harvath awoke, he felt worse than when he'd gone to bed. His body was stiffer and in more pain. Grabbing a bottle of water from the mini-fridge, he swallowed several Motrin, turned on his phone, and returned messages. Then, after a quick shower, he swung by the kitchen for a mug of coffee. Everyone else was already up. Barton and Morrison were in the gym working out, while Stalin was outside in a pair of cargo shorts working on his tan and reading another paperback, this time by Eric Larson. It was the same hot sun overhead and same ocean off in the distance, but they were worlds away from Libya. Harvath didn't begrudge his team some leisure time, especially not after everything they had been through. They had more than earned it. Making his way to the stairwell, he waved his card in front of the reader, the door unlocked, and he headed down to the infirmary. The overnight medical team had gone home, and a new team had come on. Harvath stopped briefly to speak with the doctor before walking back to check on Haney and Gage. Part of the new medical team included an attractive nurse named Olivia. When Harvath walked in, she was in the process of checking Gage's blood pressure.
"Speak of the devil," the Green Beret said as Harvath entered. "Harvath, tell this lovely woman how Haney and I threw ourselves in front of those bullets to save your life."
Harvath caught a smile, accompanied by an eye roll from the young woman. She obviously knew a couple of liars when she saw them.
"Whatever you're giving them," he said to her, "you may want to let the doc know that it's affecting their memory."
100 men, Gage continued. "When we ran out of ammo, we had to go after them with our bare hands."
Harvath ignored him and walked over to Haney.
"How's the leg?"
"I think my modeling career is going to be okay," he replied.
Harvath smiled.
"I'm glad you have something to fall back on."
"We still going to Sigonella today?"
Harvath nodded. It was one of the messages he had returned from his room.
"They're working on getting us a plane. The doc says you're good to travel. Have you eaten breakfast yet?"
Haney pointed to an empty tray off to the side.
"Omelets and fresh-squeezed OJ. It's like being at the Ritz."
"Your tax dollars at work."
The nurse removed the blood pressure cuff from Gage's arm and asked,
"Is there anything else I can get for you, gentlemen?"
"I'm good," said Haney.
"If you see Cupid on the way," Gage replied, "tell him I'm going to need my heart back."
This time, Harvath rolled his eyes.
"Try ketamine," he told her. "I guarantee he'll stop bothering you."
Olivia was a good sport. Smiling, she reminded her patients where their call buttons were and left to report back to the doctor up front. Harvath looked at his watch.
"As soon as I have an exact time on the plane, I'll fill you in. And though I know I'm going to regret asking, is there anything you guys need?"
"There is," said Gage. "According to Haney, you owe me $200.
Harvath shot Haney a look.
"A bet's a bet," Haney replied.
"You're going to a Navy hospital," said Harvath. "What are you going to spend $200 on?"
"What are you, my accountant?" Gage asked. "You've got a bag upstairs with 100 grand in cash. Go peel off a couple of C-notes for me."
"That's Uncle Sugar's money. I'll square up with you when we get home. In the meantime, leave the nurse alone. Copy?"
Gage winked at him in response and began bugging Haney, asking him how walking with a limp might affect his relationship with his wife.
"Tell the nurse to hurry up with that ketamine,"
Haney yelled after Harvath as he exited the infirmary and headed back upstairs. They stayed at the Solarium for lunch and drove out to the airport an hour later. There, a Citation XLS was on the tarmac, fueled and waiting for them. The mid-sized jet was just big enough to accommodate their team.
Haney took two of the seats facing each other so he could prop his leg up. Harvath and Gage sat facing each other across the aisle. Barton and Morrison took the two seats in the back. Stalin boarded last. As such, he was left with the side-facing seat up near the cockpit, normally reserved for a flight attendant. And the minute he sat down, that was exactly how the team treated him. As the jet taxied out onto the runway, the Delta Force operator checked the galley to see if any catering had been done for the hop over to Sicily. In typical CIA fashion, it was bare bones. No liquor, not even soft drinks, only small bottles of water. He accepted drink orders anyway. When the pilots took off the brakes and the Citation began to roar down the runway, Stalin tossed Harvath, Haney, and Gage their bottles of water. He placed the two for Barton and Morrison on the floor. As the plane took off, the bottles rolled to the back of the cabin, where Morrison reached down and picked his up. Barton did the same, but thoroughly wiped it off with his shirt before opening it and taking a drink. After a few more shots at Stalin for being a lousy stewardess, the team quieted down. Gage and Haney put their earbuds in, while Stalin opened his book. As the Citation climbed into the sky and banked out over the Mediterranean Sea, Harvath closed his eyes. He had a lot to process, not the least of which being what he was going to have to do once they landed in Italy. Chapter 47. Northern Virginia. Lydia Ryan looked at both men with disbelief. There was no way the CIA would ever allow what they were asking for. Absolutely not.
You want what? She repeated. Access to the Malice source code, said Nicholas.
Malice was an ultra-top-secret program developed by the CIA's Center for Cyber Intelligence that allowed the agency to skirt both the NSA and the FISA court in order to intercept and trace encrypted internet communications. The program was so highly effective that the CIA had gone to great lengths to mask its existence. Neither the president nor the intelligence committees had ever been briefed on it. Only in the most extreme circumstances was it ever used. She knew better than to ask how Nicholas even knew about it. She didn't want to know. Instead, she directed her next remark to Carlton.
We're talking about the most valuable weapon in the agency's hacking arsenal.
I understand that, he replied.
I don't think you do. This goes beyond anything they've ever developed. Beyond putting smart TVs into fake off mode in order to listen in on people's conversations. Beyond hacking smartphones in order to capture audio and message traffic before it gets put through an encryption app. You're talking about launching the cyber equivalent of a nuclear-tipped missile just because somebody looked at you sideways in a dark parking lot. And, unlike a nuke, once a cyber weapon like Malice is loosed, it is out there for anyone to discover and turn back around on us. This isn't a fire-and-forget system. The moment it detonates, you have to send a team into the blast zone, right into the rubble, to physically recover it. Every device it has touched, every packet of data it has stowed away inside, all of it has to be accounted for. That's what you don't understand.
I do understand, Nicholas countered. That's why all I want is access to the source code. I don't want the entire missile. I only want its guidance system.
So you can do what? Play Frankenstein? That could end up being even worse.
Lydia, I know you don't like any of this.
That's the understatement of the year, she replied.
Which is why we have to do it this way.
First, you tell me that for your hack to be convincing, you've got to turn over all my personal emails, including ones that are a little too personal. Then you drag Malice into this, something I shouldn't even be discussing with you.
If there was another way to do this, said Carlton, we wouldn't need to ask.
There has to be.
There isn't, Nicholas replied. Believe me, for the last 24 hours, I've been trying to come up with one. Your personal emails, along with Mr. Carlton's, are the Trojan horse. They're the only means by which we can get Malice into the pipeline and figure out who ordered the hack.
I can tell you right now that Bob McGee is never going to authorize this. You let me worry about Bob, said Carlton. What I need you focused on is coming up with a plan to get Nicholas inside the Center for Cyber Intelligence.
Inside?
Ryan repeated with a laugh. You've got to be kidding.
Malice can only be accessed from inside, Nicholas stated.
You know you've got a bit of a reputation at the CIA, right? They'll go batshit if they see you in there.
Which is why nobody can see him, Carlton clarified.
Any other requirements?
She asked, turning to face him. Maybe he can ride out of Langley on a unicorn. The old man smiled at her. If anyone can make it happen, it's you. Ryan didn't smile back. Instead, she asked,
How much time do we have to put this together?
Nicholas needs to go in tonight. Ryan stood up from the table. Where are you going?
Walking out of the study, she replied,
To start a hot bath while I look for some razor blades.
Chapter 48 Sicily.
I'm not riding in a fucking ambulance, said Gage, as he looked out his window at the approaching vehicles.
Yes, you are,
said Harbath.
Haney, too. That's an order. We keep a low profile and we don't cause any trouble. That goes double for the nurses. Understood?
Gage nodded and Haney flashed him the thumbs up. When the jet came to a complete stop, Stalin opened the cabin door, extended the air stairs, and said,
On behalf of your anonymous flight crew, we'd like to thank you all for flying Central Intelligence Airways this afternoon. We know you have a choice when traveling to faraway lands to interact with extremely bad people, and we appreciate your choosing CIA. Please check your seat backs and overhead compartments for any weapons you may have brought on board, and remember, you were never here.
There was a round of applause from the team. Stalin bowed, and they deplaned. In addition to the ambulance waiting to take the two wounded team members to the naval hospital, there was an older passenger van and a black SUV with tinted windows. Standing outside the SUV was Deborah Lovett, who had recently arrived from Rome. A tall, attractive woman in her mid-30s with long blonde hair, she looked more like an Eastern European tennis star than a CIA case officer.
Let's play Guess Which Vehicle Is Here for Harvath, said Morrison.
$100 says he's kicking himself for using up all his ketamine, replied Gage. Harvath shook his head as he helped retrieve bags from the plane's cargo hold. The air smelled like salt water and jet fuel. Once Gage and Haney had been loaded into the ambulance, he told Stalin, Barton, and Morrison, who were on their way to base housing, that he would catch up with them in a couple of hours. Picking up his bag, he walked over to Lovett and introduced himself.
Do your friends want a ride?
She asked, after they shook hands. Harvath looked over his shoulder and then back at her.
They're not my friends.
She smiled as he opened her door for her. Closing it, he was almost positive he heard Barton shout some sort of insult his way, but it was drowned out by a pair of F-18 Hornets as they went screaming down the runway. Hopping into the passenger seat, he asked,
Where are we headed?
To the skiff,
she replied.
SCIF stood for Sensitive Compartmented Information Facility, a secure room in which classified information could be briefed and discussed. Lovett was dressed in a black pantsuit, and while it likely had been intended to showcase her professionalism and downplay her attractiveness, it failed. Harvath tried not to look at her and instead focused his eyes on the airfield beyond the windshield. As they drove, she provided him with an update.
We received confirmation that the Libyans picked up Halim and the satellite phone salesman. They also liberated the refugees at the compound. The Red Crescent has them now.
Harvath was glad to hear it.
Any blowback from the firefights?
She shook her head, and he made the mistake of looking at her as she did. Once he locked eyes with her, it was difficult to look away. Fortunately, she had to pay attention to where she was going and broke contact.
Libyan government forces took credit for the losses that the Libya Liberation Front militia suffered, she said. That's a good PR coup for them, which, I heard, was your idea.
Wasn't me, he replied. I'm not that smart.
Out of the corner of his eye, he saw her smile.
That's us up ahead, she stated,
as they approached an unremarkable two-story building whose only distinguishing features were the antenna arrays and clusters of satellite dishes on the roof. Pulling into a parking space reserved for military officers, Lovett grabbed her credentials from the center console, a briefcase from the back seat, and with a smile that displayed her perfect white teeth, motioned for Harvath to follow her. He remembered being shown into a similar facility by a similarly attractive CIA officer at Al Dhafra Air Base outside Abu Dhabi. She had turned out to be extremely good at her job. Harvath wondered if Lovett would prove to be as well. Showing her ID to two Marines standing guard in the lobby, she led Harvath through a series of security doors and down a long hall. Its walls were lined with pictures of aircraft and assorted commendations from American units that had been based in Sigonella over the years. "Hungry?" the CIA officer asked as they arrived at a vending machine filled with plastic-wrapped sandwiches.
"No, thanks," he replied.
Lovett bought a Diet Coke from the machine next to it, and they continued walking. Arriving at a door simply marked A7, she pressed a button and they were buzzed in. He followed her into a small office where four Navy personnel sat working at gray metal desks. None of them looked up.
"Phone,"
she said, as they approached the heavy metal door of the skiff. Mounted on the wall next to it was an old wooden hotel mail sorter. Harvath wasn't excited about leaving his cell phone in an office with four strangers, even if they were U.S. military personnel, but he understood the rules and slid his into the cubby next to Lovett's.
"Coffee?"
she asked, nodding at the Keurig machine to their left.
"Actually, yes," he replied.
"You good?"
"I'm fine, thank you,"
she replied, holding up her drink. After walking over to the coffee station, Harvath brewed a cup of black coffee and added a shot of espresso. Rejoining Lovett at the door to the skiff, he smiled and said,
"Good to go."
The CIA officer nodded, punched a code into the keypad, and then opened the door. Chapter 49. Skiffs were designed to be immune to electric eavesdropping and surveillance. The moment you entered, the first thing that struck most people was the silence. It was like walking into a tomb. It was lit from overhead with strips of white LED lighting and smelled like compressed air. In the center was a chipped blue Formica conference table, surrounded by gray faux leather chairs. At the front of the room were three flat-panel monitors, as well as two workstations. Harvath and Lovett were the only people there. Removing a laptop from her briefcase, she plugged it into a port beneath the conference table and motioned for Harvath to sit.
"What do you know about ISIS and its ties to the Italian mafia?" she asked.
"Not much,"
Harvath replied.
"Though I'd imagine there are some areas where their interests overlap."
"More than just some."
Once she had her computer powered up, she opened PowerPoint, and an image of Roman ruins appeared on all the monitors. Harvath recognized them immediately.
"Palmyra,"
he said.
"Syria."
She was impressed.
"You know it.
All too well."
On a recent assignment, Harvath had barely escaped that part of Syria with his life. He had passed right through Palmyra. What ISIS had done to that ancient city was as bad as what the Taliban and their RPGs had done to the Bamiyan statues of Buddha in Afghanistan.
"Across Syria, Iraq, and Libya, ISIS has overrun UNESCO World Heritage Sites, slaughtering archaeologists and plundering everything they can get their hands on."
As she spoke, she backed her points up with slide after slide.
"They load the looted artifacts onto cargo ships headed for southern Italian ports. There, the mafia usually purchases them with cash. Increasingly, though, we're seeing payment made in weapons. The mafia then helps smuggle the weapons farther north into Europe, where ISIS and other terror groups can carry out attacks."
Immediately, Harvath's mind was drawn to what had happened at the cathedral in Spain.
"What about explosives?"
he asked. Lovett nodded.
"The Italian organized crime groups are all interconnected. The Cosa Nostra, the Camorra, the 'Ndrangheta. What one doesn't have, the other can get. They're supplied by an array of arms dealers from Ukraine, Russia, and other places across the Balkans and Eastern Europe."
"What about the name I gave you? The guy our Libyan smuggler, Halim, gave up?"
She took a sip of her Diet Coke and pulled up a new series of images, surveillance photos taken by Italian police.
Sicily is home to a highly organized, ruthless Nigerian criminal network known as the Black Axe. They operate with the permission of the Sicilian Mafia. The name you gave me, Festus Agaku, he was a tassista for the Black Axe. It's Italian for taxi driver. His job was to meet the smuggling boats from Libya out at sea and sneak in high-paying customers before Italian authorities could get to them.
Harvath held up his hand and interrupted.
You said his job was to meet the smuggling boats from Libya. What's he doing now?
Lovett advanced to her next slide.
He's dead.
The image showed a corpse inside an unzipped body bag.
What happened to him?
He drowned the same night, the same storm as your chemistry student, Mustafa Marzouk. The Italians have a handful of informants in the Black Axe. From what I've been able to gather, Lovett continued, Festus Agaku didn't want to go out that night, but he was forced to.
Forced by whom?
The Sicilian Mafia. Allegedly, there was a VIP who needed to be picked up off the coast of Lampedusa. The Cosa Nostra didn't care about the storm. Festus Agaku was a dead man if he didn't go.
So, what happened?
He went. The storm was much worse than predicted. The boat sank. He and two Nigerian crew members drowned.
Do we know who the VIP was?
Harvath asked.
Did they mention Mustafa Marzouk by name?
No.
What about where he was going once he reached Italy?
Lovett shook her head.
They didn't mention that either. But they wouldn't have known his final destination. That's not how it's set up. The Black Axe runs the water taxi portion. That's it. Once the customer gets to dry land, the Cosa Nostra takes over. Then they run the smuggling routes up through Italy and into the rest of Europe.
Harvath hated the Mafia. They thrived on human suffering. He didn't care if they were Italian, Nigerian, or Libyan. Profiting off other people's misery, they were nothing more than animals in his book. The Sicilians were some of the most violent. They paid lip service to honor and respect while they trafficked in drugs, money laundering, blackmail, weapons, and terrorism. There was nothing honorable or respectable about how they made their livings.
So, who would have been in charge of getting Mustafa Marzouk to his final destination?
He asked. The CIA officer advanced to her next slide. On it was a 60-something-year-old man with dark olive-colored skin, a prominent Roman nose, and a pair of green eyes saddled with heavy bags. His receding hairline had gone gray and boasted two prominent widow's peaks.
Meet Carlo Ragusa. Anything and everything the Black Axe does in Sicily, it does because Ragusa allows them to. He's the one who sent Festus Agaku and his crew into the storm that night. He's also the one who can tell you where Mustafa Marzouk was headed.
It was some of the best news Harvath had gotten yet.
Where do I find him?
Lovett winced and clicked to her next slide. Chapter 50. Paris. Turzanov checked out of his hotel late that morning and took the train out to Charles de Gaulle Airport. There, he caught a taxi back into the city and, under a different passport, checked into Le Maurice, the grand luxury hotel on the Rue de Rivoli. It resembled a modern-day Versailles. Gilded mirrors, silk draperies, crystal chandeliers, and velvet couches. He was offended by the opulence. Opening the doors to his balcony, the cacophony from the street below pierced the cashmere-wrapped silence of the suite. Horns blared, brakes squealed, and engines growled. Trucks rumbled past, and scooters buzzed like angry wasps. Removing his Gauloise, he slid one from the pack, placed it between his lips, and struck a match. Inhaling a cloud of leathery smoke into his lungs, he leaned forward against the wrought iron railing and smiled. The view was perfect. He was directly across the street from the Jardin des Tuileries. From where he stood, he could look out over the entirety of the Terrasse de Feuillon, the area along the edge of the park where the Fête des Tuileries was in full swing, and where the attack would take place. He had the perfect front row seat. Like the Spanish coordinator in Santiago, Abdul would be close, just in case his men chickened out. He had the numbers of the cell phones attached to their vests programmed into his phone. If something happened, if they didn't go off at the appointed time, he would detonate them remotely. That meant that the Moroccan would be someplace where he could watch the event unfold without attracting attention. Tursunov had no idea where. That was by design. The less they knew about each other's movements, the better. The more compartmentalized they were, the less chance there was of the full plot being discovered. It was a similar blueprint to what had been carried out in Spain. The only person who interacted with him was the head of operations for the country. The martyrs themselves never saw his face. They didn't need to. All that mattered was that they do their job. After cutting the throat of the drug dealer, Tursunov had contacted Abdul and arranged to meet. The Moroccan didn't want to believe that his nephew was involved in a drug ring, but based on what Tursunov explained to him, he had no choice. Sharing his concern that the chemist's apartment, phone, and email communications were being monitored, the Tajik laid out a very specific course of action he wanted Abdul to follow. Then he handed him a stack of banknotes and a clean cell phone. It hadn't taken long for the dead lieutenant's body in the men's room to be discovered. As soon as the police were called, the undercover officers following the chemist and his two drug-cooking cohorts descended on the cafe. After initial questioning at the scene, all three were taken in for further interrogation. It was an attempt to get the trio to admit to what the police already suspected them of, drug manufacturing. They knew the young men were not involved in the murder. The victim was part of the gang they cooked for. There was also a trail of partial bloody footprints that led out the back of the cafe. Having been a cop for many years, Tursunov knew what kind of exculpatory evidence to leave behind. As long as the chemist and his colleagues didn't have blood on their shoes, which they didn't, and there was nothing else incriminating on them, there was only so long that the French police would be able to hold them. When they were released, that was when the chemist was going to have to make his move. That was what Tursunov had prepped the uncle for. Because he was family, Abdul could approach the young man without drawing interest